This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today our show is going to start with a popular topic. It's food. First Fridays at B is an event where people gather to discuss important food topics. This month it focused on the food worker shortage. The featured guests were Kyle Armitage, Associate Professor of Culinary Arts at the North Dakota State College of Science, Lisa Gibson of Sanford Health, and Nicole Henson of Nicole's Fine Pastry. Today we share an excerpt from that conversation, beginning with Lisa, who talks about hiring support staff for a new medical center.
So what I want to kind of start my talk about was to say that really as an overall society or culture and focus on culinary is that we really need to change the paradigm of like how our parents and other people think about food service, because they typically think food service is fast food workers, 14, 15, 16 years of age. You never think that you're going to actually kind of move into a career with that. Even going to culinary school, you still kind of don't know exactly where you're going to end up or how you're going to fit in, whether it's going to be on a commercial side, whether you're doing restaurants, or if you do non-commercial, which is where I spend a good majority of my time working in college and university food service and working in healthcare. And it's an incredible shift. There has been an incredible shift just in my lifetime, because never did I think we'd have a network that just focused on food, right? And we not only have one, but we have a tremendous number of them. So really, we need to be proud about the fact that this is what we do for a living and really try to mentor and coach people along, whether that's young or old. Sometimes it doesn't matter. So overall, I think just shifting the way we think about food service, and not in a negative connotation, or it's just a temporary job. It really can be a career if that's what you want it to be overall. So as you can imagine, working at Sanford, under food service, I have more than 350 employees. And so really when we were thinking about building the new medical center, knowing that a good majority of the people that we needed to hire were going to be support staff, because a lot of the medical staff were just transferring from the downtown Broadway campus. So we really had to get clever and think about how are we going to recruit in a very, very, very tough recruiting environment. And so we kind of put our heads together and came up with a lot of different things to try to get people to really be excited about working in healthcare, because honestly, it's very policy driven. We are cleaner than clean. It's not like working in a restaurant. It's vastly different. There's a little bit of a language issue from restaurant to healthcare, and meaning that you can't curse and swear. You can't lose your temper and those kinds of things. And so we try to treat everybody with respect. So we try to think about how are we going to make that transition and what kind of environment can we create, as a team, to really kind of get people interested in it. And so we did a number of different things, honestly. Obviously, wage, salary, you have to take a look at that and you have to see what other people are paying. You have to be at least comparable or close to it. But we also put into place, if they had any years of experience, we would increase that starting wage by 1% to 2%. Depending upon if it was direct applicable experience or if it was kind of indirect experience. So we did that. We knew we needed to do that bottom line because, I mean, we were at like $9.25 an hour. That just wasn't going to work. But outside of that, what could we do? So we started really thinking about how we could create tiers within our department in terms of we could hire associate cooks and teach them great skills and move them through to be a cook, then a lead cook, and then potentially a chef supervisor. And so we kind of put together a tiered approach to that, and we did that in all of our areas, not just in cooking. We also have it in our food service area, from dishwasher all the way up to room service assistant. Those are all kind of lumped together. And so you can move through those systems and be hired as a food service assistant and aspire to move up in the company. We didn't have those before, so that was really important. Obviously, we had to take a look at, you know, the benefits, PTO. That's something that's more enterprise-driven. But there's other things that we could do as an environment, like our just local department, that could really help people. And that was to have more flexible scheduling, people that need to take their children and their daycare doesn't open till 7 a.m., tried to be more flexible with scheduling, tried to create positions that are full-time, so that they don't necessarily have to work another part-time job. A lot of different creative scheduling like that as well. One of the other things that we did is we asked to be part of the internship program. We had never had culinary interns at Sanford before. And so we went to the medical side of the internship program, and we said, we really want culinary interns. And so for the last 3 or 4 years, we've had culinary interns. I think for the most part, I had at least a 50 or 60% ratio that we've kept, and they're actually currently working for us. We had a few that, you know, wanted to open restaurants, and that's cool too. So, but we really enjoy having the interns work with us. We also try very hard to do cross-training, and we created with our HR department the ability to be able to do secondary codes for people. So if we have someone who's working as a dishwasher, and believe it or not, we have this currently in our system, we have someone who's a dishwasher that aspires to be a cook, so we get them a secondary code so that they're able to work as a prep cook, get paid that associate cook wage, and learn on the job. And so obviously our end result is that we're hoping that these people will be inspired to work on our line. We really changed a lot of things about healthcare food service when we opened the new medical center. We are all restaurant driven. We have very little quantity food except for in our central kitchen. Everything is line cooking. And so it's very important that, and we're competing with all the restaurants for those line cooks. So we thought creating this tier that we can help people move through and actually give them, inspire them, give them education would be greatly important. So as far as community support, I think that one of the things that really we didn't really think about too hard when we built the new medical center was the area in which that center is built. A lot of the housing in and around there is not very affordable, especially not for someone who makes $12 to $15 an hour. And so we kind of missed that a little bit. So a lot of our staff drive to that area, and so that creates a transit problem. And so from a community standpoint, we really needed to think about that a little bit. We didn't think about it, and now we're being reactive to it. So that's an unfortunate miss on our part overall. And then I've had the privilege to be part of the Culinary Institute that they're trying to get going in downtown Fargo. And I really feel wholeheartedly that something like this in our downtown area is really going to help attract young culinarians to our area, regardless if it's for restaurants or non-commercial food service. It doesn't really matter. It helps us all.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public, and you just heard Sanford Health's Lisa Gibson speaking at February's First Friday at B event. Next, you'll hear Kyle Armitage, an associate professor of culinary arts. He says one way to address the food worker shortage is to increase the number of people interested in those careers.
I'm a culinary instructor at North Dakota State College of Science in Wahpeton, and I work with all of our freshmen, first-year incoming students, and really starting to train them for what the industry is asking of them. I have to say I have a little bit of a unique view. I would say the opportunity to see a unique picture of both sides. The supply as students come in and the job that I need to do, and then I get to see the trenches and hear the stories from the employers that are sometimes in nearly tears. You know, you can't probably hear tears through an email, but you can almost. So the desire for those students to be there. Now, yes, I'm supposed to teach students how to hold a knife and to understand individual ingredients and to cook good food. But I think in a larger setting, I'm there to teach students passion. So I talk a lot about, you know, if you are passionate about something, you do it for fun. And I think we understand, all of us that are connected to the food world, that this isn't always the easiest industry. The hours may not be the greatest. Your coworkers may not be the greatest, but that really isn't any different than any industry that we're all in. So my goal ultimately is to create passion in those students so that they're excited to go to work every day. I think we can be a solution to the shortage, but on the front end, there's also a shortage, right? Those students incoming, those students transitioning into the food world, encouraging those people, young people or people in second careers, to say that this is a valid industry. Our parents need to understand that this is a job that has value, that can be enjoyable, that you should like to do on a daily basis. Our school counselors, encouraging those students who show this interest and maybe are a high-achieving student, that a four-year college isn't always the route. There's a lot of industries right now, especially in the skills, that need people, and culinary is no different. My goal really is to be that connection from the industry to those students, and we work hard to stay with what our industry is asking of them. So we have, obviously, advisory boards and that kind of thing that help us set our standards and train those students and hopefully get them ready for day one for what they're going to do. Employers, I would say we get probably 3 to 4 connections per week throughout the region saying we need people. And it's all segments. Obviously, we know the restaurant industry is in need, but healthcare is a huge segment of what we do. Small, obviously, individual restaurants, bakeries, grocery stores, all of those things are reaching out to us, I would say, all the way from Montana, South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin. Again, one of the goals that we have is to make a larger impact. So the project that we're working with, the North Dakota Culinary Institute, could be that great connection between what our region needs and what is there. So a couple of stories. I had a student, her name was Carrie, and it was kind of a funny story. She was about in her second year, and she came to me and she said, you know, this is where I need to be. And me, I'm like, yes, you know, that's my goal, right? I want those students to realize that this is it. She goes, you don't realize what it took for me to get here. And I said, oh, okay. And she said, you know, when I told my parents that I was going to go to culinary school, they nearly disowned me. And I thought, what? Really? I mean, this is what I do, right? I'm like, come on now, we're pretty good. She said, my dad was so mad. He said, you might as well be a garbage man. And I went, I don't know. I know some garbage men. They do pretty well. They got more work than they can handle. So she continues to be successful to this day and continues to love what she does. And I think that's very important for what we do. I tell students, young people, all the time, right? You're going to have a job for a very long time, right? But it shouldn't be work, right? You're going to have those days where you don't want to get out of bed and you don't want to do that, but you should like what you do. And the last story of a student, recent graduate named Joe, We always talk about their, you know, life being a path to where they're eventually going to be. Joe went to NDSU for law enforcement and said, you know what, this is not for me. And Joe came to us, and the light bulb went on that same moment where he said, this is it. So Joe works, has been very successful, still works in the area today, and Joe is now co-owner of Mezzaluna. So Joe is one person we're very, very proud of.
That was Kyle Armitage, who teaches culinary arts at the North Dakota State College of Science. Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about the food worker shortage from the perspective of the owner of a well-known Fargo pastry shop.
The International Artist Series of Minot presents Canadian Country Music Award nominees Twin Kennedy live in concert at Ann Nicole Nelson Hall on Sunday, February 24th at 3 p.m. Twin sisters Carly and Julie Kennedy have been making music together since they could talk. Known for their sibling harmonies, high-energy show, and heartfelt songwriting, Twin Kennedy blends their classical training with their country roots to create a unique program for all ages. More information and tickets available for the International Artist Series can be found online at minotconcerts.org or by phone at 701-838-1113.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we've been hearing from food industry professionals who spoke at the February 1st Fridays at B event. The next voice you'll hear will be Nicole Henson's. She's the owner and operator of a very well-known pastry shop and restaurant, Nicole's Fine Pastry in Fargo.
I grew up on a farm north of Minot, North Dakota, only child. Was always scared I would never amount to anything. I might have gone overboard. Out of high school, went to UND, started in accounting. Thought I would make something of myself in that realm. And in college, I worked at a deli, a little part-time job, wanted to go on a spring trip or something, needed to earn some money. That food bug got me. I really enjoyed working at that little deli downtown Grand Forks. So partway through my business degree, I started to check into culinary school. And I'm sorry, Kyle, I didn't even think about Wahpeton. I had my sights on Culinary Institute of America, Hyde Park, and then decided, well, maybe Greystone's a better fit. After I finished college, I went out there. And then kept getting calls from a previous employer to come back to Fargo. And I finally was like, okay, I'm out in California all by myself. What am I doing out here? Time to get back to my state and do something good. So I'm happy to say yesterday was the completion of 16 years in business. That's a big accomplishment. Thanks to the two ladies sitting up front. They are now part of that effort to keep us going forward. I think if I had started in a business, not knowing how things would go, putting your finances on the line, and committing your life to the business, it's a major decision. That's kind of a big step. And if I had thought about it too hard, about the roller coaster ride I was about to get on, I may not have taken the leap. Many of us know the statistics on food businesses, and failure is extremely high. I didn't think about that. I just kept my eye on the ball, and that's what I wanted to do, so here we go. With those odds, why does someone open a business? Well, I started Nicole's Fine Pastry to have a nice place to work. I liked Fargo. There wasn't many places in town with my education that I wanted to work, so let's start a place. I was thinking about myself. As an only kid, that's what we do. When I came back to California, or from California in 98, downtown was still quite sluggish. But about that time, there was a momentum that was starting to happen. And luckily, my choice of location worked well. It seemed like a pastry shop and Fargo seemed to come together. So when I started, I was the only one in the kitchen. I had no idea to know what was coming, but let's just get going. Couple weeks in, I added one person. From there, I have steadily added either counter staff or kitchen staff, and now there's almost 30 of us. When it comes to staff, I feel like I've been very fortunate. Most of the time, individuals that see the quality of what is being done show up on their own and want to be part of the effort. Once I put an ad in job service and decided, no, I'm not going to do that again because it just created a lot of paperwork for me that I didn't have time to deal with. And nothing against job service, I just was more willing to let the people come in the door that wanted to work there. I think along the way, I just tried to be a decent human being. I grew up with, I want to say, good upbringing, farm sense, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, there's been times when people have applied that have had more experience or education than those already employed. And I probably have missed out on some great hires because of not trading one person in for another. It doesn't seem very humane to do that. I just always believe you should treat other people the way you would like to be treated. Okay. As the food scene has grown in the FM area and demand has increased, it's been a challenge to stay properly staffed as the shop has continued to grow. I recall one time a few years ago, we talked about the schedule and went, uh-oh, we might have to close early. We don't have enough staff to keep this place going for the hours that we've got. Luckily, we managed through that. You put your heads together and come up with a little creative scheduling and you make it through. Like I mentioned, when I started Nicole's, my goal was to create a great place to work for myself. Food service is notorious for being hard on people, and thus many people do not make a career out of it. I've always believed it was possible to create a business that could strike a balance between something I love to do and not work myself to death. I know my dad was worried about that when I said, I'm going to go to pastry school and maybe I'll start a business. He farmed and he knew how hard that was, but he also had known how hard you work in the restaurant industry. And I'm sure he just didn't want that for me, but he didn't say too much when I went to school. Over the years, it became clear to me that continuing to invest in my staff would help Nicole survive the long haul. And along the way then, well, benefits, okay? Corporations have got big benefit packages. How am I going to compete against that? There's simple ways to show appreciation beyond the formal. I've tried to show my gratefulness, have staff parties a couple times a year, cards different times. I don't do that enough. I should do it more. You two can poke at me to get those cards going. I think keeping it real is part of what helps build a family culture. Even in the middle of a big project, we have a big project for Prairie Public coming up, I get very focused on the work. I forget to stop and say thank you for all your hard work as we're digging in to get it done. So I try and do that. In my quest to take care of myself and my staff, I've added paid holidays, then a group health insurance plan, then an IRA, and last year I added paid time off. So the shop is adjusting to all of those benefits in different ways, and I think in the end it'll be good. So I wanted to be good to those working for me. It's demanding, challenging work. Sometimes you do simple tasks over and over again, and those tasks are not always as glamorous as TV makes it out to be. Hollywood has a way of putting a glamour on the whole thing, and that's great, but reality, those tart shells still have to get done, and it's a bunch of repetitive work. Building a team that is cross-trained enough to cover ups and downs is also very beneficial. Having a flexible schedule so that if you have a family event you want to go to, you can go. 10 years ago, 15 years ago when I started, we didn't talk about it because we knew if one of us left the kitchen, somebody else was going to be there till 9 o'clock that night doing their work. Now we've got more staff on board, so we can, and they're doing a great job of it. I don't even know half the time who's coming and going, but the work seems to get done, and that's what I guess I care about. The cake's got to get put in the box. And as an owner manager, there needs to be a balance when trying to get the most out of people without pushing them further than they want to be pushed. I'm kind of an overachiever, so I want us to put the best product out. And sometimes dealing with the stress of meeting customers' expectations at the same time you're enlightening each other on how things could or should be done, it maybe doesn't come out the nicest. There's constructive criticism. There's unconstructive criticism, too. And in the heat of the moment, are things always going to get said perfectly? No. Is your personality going to take it the same way somebody over here did? No. Sorry. But the bottom line is we need to put a good product out. So that's where we, you know, want to keep our focus. I think, too, when a community is in a worker shortage, it puts the leader in a spot of having to be very careful how or what you say to your staff, as you might fear they'll quit. Now, I don't feel that on a daily basis, but every once in a while, I pick my battles. Choosing, the perfect wording tailored to an individual, fast-paced environment, it doesn't always come out sweetly. You know, there is a topic of, we've maybe heard it, poaching in the restaurant world. I think I haven't witnessed it. And I just believe my goal has been to focus on building a business that attracts good people. I think that's the long-term fix. So during the past few years, this area has definitely endured a shortage. Last year I heard that the FM area per capita has the most restaurants in the country. I don't know the details of that. I would like to know why that is. How is Fargo-Moorhead getting so many restaurants? Who's in charge of all of this? Because I certainly don't feel like I am. I think there's another component to retaining your staff over the long haul, and it's to be compassionate. Financial compensation is only one part of the equation, and if you are someone who truly enjoys and thrives in the hospitality world, you still need the support of your teammates. Continuing to pace yourself for long-term success requires attention to one another, and I think many in the food service world say they value close coworkers like family. You know, many restaurants, they speak of family meal. Well, why is that? You know, sure, they're trying the food, but they're also bonding when they eat together. I think it's a healthy thing to do in the industry. So the end of last year, I want to say, I decided to kind of consciously make a choice that, okay, it's time to take some of the staff that are at the shop that are very serious about being there. They're committed. They've gone to school. They're showing enthusiasm. I can speak on one person from Kyle's program. He definitely puts passion in his students, and that's great. I think it is to allow some of the staff that's at the shop to help in other capacities so they have a more well-rounded day. Just being in the kitchen, producing product, baking cake, scooping cookies, maybe doesn't do it for them. Maybe they need to help out in some other capacities. They've got strengths in other areas, marketing, personnel management, graphic design. I've got a young lady helping at the counter. She's a good graphic designer. Okay, let's take that back in-house and do it there. That helps make her day, takes the stress off of one spot, puts it in another, benefits the business. I think that way we all win.
That was Nicole Hinson of Nicole's Fine Pastry in Fargo. Earlier in our show, you heard Lisa Gibson with Sanford Health and Kyle Armitage, who teaches culinary arts at the North Dakota State College of Science. They were speaking at a monthly event known as First Fridays at B, which usually takes place at Theater B in North Moorhead. This one took place at Dakota Medical Foundation in Fargo. Next on Main Street, a conversation with Nick Archuleta, president of North Dakota United, about the state of the teaching profession and what his organization is watching at the North Dakota Legislature.
Have you told a lie today? Psychologist Dan Ariely says dishonesty can be a sign of a creative mind.
Why do creative people cheat more? Because cheating is all about being able to tell a story about why what we want is actually okay.
Escaping the Truth, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Nick Archuleta. He's the president of North Dakota United. That's the merger created several years ago of North Dakota Education Association and the state's Public Employees Association. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Doug. Thank you for having me.
What is the mission of North Dakota United, just for our listeners, to give them an orientation?
Well, North Dakota United represents, as you mentioned, folks from the education field and people in public service. And so our job is to, at North Dakota United is to make sure that their interests are being heard not just at the legislature here in Bismarck, but in Washington, D.C. as well. We have our members provide very vital public services that the public depends on every single day in North Dakota, and we are very happy to represent them.
And you have 11,000 members, so it's a pretty big organization in this state.
It really is. I think it's the largest labor organization in the state.
Well, this week is crossover week at the legislature. I know you spend a lot of time there because, after all, there are issues that affect public employees and teachers. Crossover, the Senate plans to finish on Wednesday, the House on Thursday. That means they'll exchange bills. And what are you watching in particular?
Well, we're watching several things, to be honest with you. As it relates to our some of our K-12 membership, there's House Bill 1347, which is a probationary teacher bill. Right now in North Dakota, Doug, a probationary teacher, they're on probation for their first year of teaching. And during that time, they are evaluated by their building principals or vice principals. And if they need some supports, if they need some refinement in their practice, this is the time to give them that extra help that they might need. What 1347 would do is that it extend that period from 1 year to 3 years. When this bill was first introduced, it also took away representation rights from teachers during that three-year time period so that they didn't even have to be told or why they were being let go if that was going to be the decision. We thought that was incredibly unfair. We worked with the committee. They amended all that bad workplace language out and replaced it to the way that it was and should be. But they're still insisting on the three-year probationary period. That bill will come up either very soon, and we'll see what they end up doing with it. But we think that it's a bill that's really quite unnecessary. For example, it doesn't really require administrators to do anything. And if administrators are doing their job, they're in there evaluating those probationary teachers, and they should be able to do that now. So,
well, who is proposing this bill? I'm not talking about the legislature, but who are they advocating for?
Well, I believe that they're advocating for administrators, to be honest with you, that they don't feel they have enough time, and they also feel that it's very difficult to fire a teacher after their first year. Well, we've testified that that isn't the case at all. If you want to dismiss a teacher, no matter where they are in the in their career, it's a relatively easy process. You do the evaluation of the teachers. You let them know that they're going to be non-renewed, and then you convince the school board that that's the right call. I mean, it's very, very simple. But it does require you to document and do those kinds of things that some administrators may not have the time to do.
Well, new teachers can really struggle in those first years. That's a tough transition from the classroom to the real classroom.
Well, it certainly is. And we are confident that they are being prepared well in our colleges and universities for the job. But there is a mentoring program offered by the state, and it's underutilized, to be quite frankly, to be frank about it. Many school districts don't avail themselves of the opportunity to have this extra help that's supplied by the North Dakota Mentoring Program, which is run by the Education Standards and Practices Board. And not that there isn't a demand. There was a waiting list, but unfortunately that mentoring program has seen its budget cut over the last few sessions, and in fact it's up for another 6% cut this year. So, and here's something else about that. This bill now says that an administrator has to offer mentoring to these teachers. Unfortunately, the state mentoring plan only covers the first year. There isn't a year two or a year three. Frankly, they might be out of luck.
I went to your website, ndunited.org, and saw that you're watching a number of bills that would allow guns in schools and other public places.
Yeah, there are always gun bills in the legislature, and that's fine. I think what was going to come down, though, is House Bill 1332. This is a bill that would allow armed first responders. And there has a training component to it. We, of course, don't advocate for arming teachers or staff or anybody that's in charge of students because let's just say that there was a shooting incident in a school. We know that those teachers have a job to do and we know that administrators have a job to do. Our choice would be to have an all-of-the-above sort of response to the issue of violence in our schools. First of all, we need more money being spent on behavioral health so that we can mitigate some of these issues that cause individuals to want to come in and shoot up a school. We need a better training for our teachers. We need more counselors. We need more social workers in our elementary schools where we see an awful lot of acting out. And if we can intervene early enough, maybe we can mitigate those violent interactions later on.
Well, let's talk about another bill because, again, you are also representing public employees, and there's a House Bill 1463. This is an act to provide for collective bargaining for law enforcement officers and paid full-time firefighters.
Right, and I believe that has already failed in the House, and that's unfortunate. You know, we've heard all the platitudes about how much we appreciate and really rely on the work of policemen and firemen and women across the state. And they are. They're there. They're there to protect us. They're there to help us. We believe that they deserve the voice to negotiate the terms and conditions of their employment. Now, that bill didn't have any stipulation in it that would have allowed them to strike. You know, and that's as it should be. They shouldn't be able to strike. But it does give them a voice at the negotiating table so that they can negotiate the best contract they can for themselves and their families.
Well, how is it done now? I mean, why don't they have a voice?
We're a right-to-work state, for one thing. And
sure.
And so that component has never been there. And I would suggest that maybe it's time to investigate putting that there. In all of these areas, we're having for example, in teaching, there's a teacher shortage in the state of North Dakota and around the country. We want to make sure that our communities are offering the best packages that they can so they can recruit and retain the best firefighters, the best policemen, the best teachers, and public employees. So I think this bill, in my mind anyway, makes an awful lot of sense.
Well, you mentioned that there's a shortage of teachers around the country and in our state. There's also I've been reading about a difficulty recruiting new police officers in parts of our country. And you mentioned right-to-work states, North Dakota being one of them. You've got a lot of teachers actually striking or taking employment action in states that are right-to-work states now.
Yes, that's true. And I think you saw that beginning last year in places like West Virginia and Kentucky and Colorado and Arizona and Oklahoma, where teachers walked out of their classrooms in support of their students. For many years around the country, public education has not been very well supported. I won't say that's the case here in North Dakota, but it's certainly in those areas that I mentioned, they saw year after year after year of budget cuts. Well, it gets to the point where the teachers in those classrooms realize that somebody needs to stand up for these students, and that's what they did. And they were able to, in all of those places, improve funding for education in their states. Nobody wants to do that. For example, the strike that's going on right now in Denver. They haven't had a strike there for 25 years, but every once in a while there comes a time to make a correction, and that's unfortunately for them, that's this time.
As I mentioned, this is crossover week at the North Dakota legislature. Those bills that have passed the House go to the Senate, and those bills in the Senate that have won the majority vote go to the House for deliberation there. Ultimately, perhaps some of these go to the governor. Let's talk about some of the bills and their status, whether they made it to crossover. Senate Bill 2228 is the Teacher Professional Development Conferences Bill. What was that about?
Well, I think what they were trying to do with this bill was to better utilize those 2 days that are in October that are set aside now in statute that if there is a professional educators conference, whether it's the administrators or we used to host one, North Dakota United did, then there couldn't be any school or any events on those days because the teachers or the administrators would be out of the classroom or out of the building. So then those students had what was typically referred to as the teacher conference break.
Yeah.
And, well, years ago, they stopped making those days paid for teachers. And so teachers had a decision to make. Did they want to, you know, take these 2 days for which they weren't being paid for, incur the expense of traveling to Fargo or Bismarck or Grand Forks or Minot, and complete with all the expenses, whether it's childcare, gas, lodging, meals, and attend that thing for which they weren't being paid, or would they turn those into vacations? Well, many of them just started, did what most people would do, and that is to try and save some money, and they used those days in a different way. So really now we have the Department of Public Instruction, with whom North Dakota United works to put on their fall conference, where we had 650 teachers, I think, last year that attended. So that's one of the big conferences. And then the other one is the North Dakota Council of Education Leaders. They have a conference as well, they weren't on the same date. So I think what the sponsors of this bill, and I believe it was Joan Heckman's bill, were trying to do was to better utilize that time, make sure that we were having people getting meaningful public or professional development at the same time. Well, that bill failed. And basically the committee chair said, education stakeholder groups need to work this out yourself because you probably won't like it if the legislature has to intervene. So I think during this interim, we're going to find a way to work together to see that we can do these conferences so that everybody benefits.
Nick, you're essentially a lobbyist for North Dakota United, aren't you?
I am.
So what do you make of the lobbying and constitutional amendment for an ethics commission? That's been passed. That's an amendment to the North Dakota Constitution. Now they're trying to put together the commission. Where are you on that discussion?
Well, during the campaign for that, we had both sides come in to our North Dakota United Board of Directors meeting, and both sides presented at the same time why they were for or why they were opposed to the ethics bill. Our board, following that, of course, our board took a vote to support the constitutional amendment, and we did. We didn't put any money behind the campaign or anything more than just offer our support. Now, of course, they're in the process of writing the rules for that constitutional amendment and for the ethics commission, and it'll be interesting to see how what they come up with. I do know that what we would like to see is more transparency. North Dakota United, we've never been a group that has spent a lot of money whining and dining legislators. They already get a stipend. We feel that that's probably adequate. But we do want, and we still didn't have any trouble getting access to them. I mean, so I don't think you necessarily need to do all the extra expenditures to get your point across. So we're waiting to see what they come up with. We are hopeful that it'll be something that's very transparent and in the spirit of that was intended when the voters of North Dakota adopted it.
Let's talk about some of these other bills and their status right now. Senate Bill 2320 is the Free Speech at Higher Education Institutions Bill. What's the North Dakota United's position on that?
Well, that was voted out last week, and with a do-pass recommendation from the Senate Education Committee, it is very much amended. And some of the concerns that we had was that it had a bit of a stifling effect on what university professors could say in their classrooms. The language we thought was unnecessarily vague. And there was also a component to it that would have allowed university professors to be sued for something they've said in their classrooms.
Ouch.
and anywhere from 1,000 to 100,000, exactly. So in committee, the case was made in committee that perhaps that was unnecessary language that didn't need to be in that bill. And so much of that was amended out. In fact, all of the things that we were concerned about and that the North Dakota University system, frankly, was concerned about were amended out. And basically, the bill now does something like it guarantees free speech for students regardless of your political point of view or your background or whatever. So everyone is operating under the same rules in university campuses.
Well, it's hard to argue with that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
How about House Bill 1536, the Legislative Authority to Set Tuition Rates Bill?
Yeah, that I think that bill came out of some frustration on the part of some folks in the legislature who want more control over how universities are run. And my recollection is that bill was defeated. It certainly sent a strong signal that the legislature is watching and they do have some expectations about tuition rates on campuses. Frankly, we were not in favor of that. We think that the universities are capable of assessing what their needs are and setting their tuitions accordingly. If they set them too high, of course, then enrollment will drop off, and they don't want that. So we think that they have a good idea, their finger on the pulse of what's going on in their campuses and what their market will endure. So we were fairly happy, of course, that bill was defeated.
Well, that leads us to that sort of political football, the higher ed governance bill, how many boards and all that kind of stuff.
Right, exactly. And I don't know that we've seen the end of this yet. I do know that the governor's a proposal for the three boards was defeated. We are still waiting to see what maybe the Senate might come up with. There are all kinds of things at play still in that regard. We do know that the legislature isn't always happy with the present governance system, and so I guess we'll just have to wait and see what finally rolls out.
Well, earlier this month, this is some great news. Leah Jolke, a language arts educator for English learner students at Fargo South, and the winner of last year's North Dakota Teacher of the Year honor, got another prestigious award. Tell our listeners what it was.
Yes. In fact, Leah was one of the four finalists for the Horace Mann Outstanding Educator Award. She did a wonderful job representing North Dakota. And the work that she does, for those of your listeners who don't know, she works very hard with new Americans. And she works in a capacity where she gives them great confidence in their abilities. So they've published a book about their stories and how they came to America and some of their hopes and dreams and fears. And she's also worked with North Dakota State University and Concordia College to give them spaces so that they can do these things to read their stories and to share their stories. By doing so, making these students more a part of our community and a vital part of our community. So we were, of course, very proud of the work that she has done, as well as how she represented North Dakota.
Well, we've had Leah and some of her students on our show. The journals they write go into these booklets that are called Journey to America. And it's just a wonderful teaching tool to have these people who are learning a new language write in that language their story, their journey to America. It's inspiring, actually.
It is very inspiring. And the message that I took from it was that we should be very, very grateful for what we have in this country. My father-in-law is fond of saying, you should wake up and be happy every day that you were born in America. and that's the absolute truth. I think that by sharing their stories, that they can make us all glad that we were born where we were.
Well, we should also mention that we collaborate with North Dakota United. The Cutting Ed podcast includes Prairie Public, North Dakota United, and entrepreneur Ted Dinter-Smith. Remind our listeners of the purpose of that.
Well, the purpose of that is to highlight the really truly innovative and good work that's being done in our schools, our public schools across the state. Ted Dinter-Smith is a gentleman whom I came to know a couple of years ago, and he has written a terrific book called What School Could Be, and it is just an absolute eye-opener for some folks. He comes from the world of finance, but he has a real interest in making education, public education, inspiring to the students who are learning, making sure that what they're learning is actually something that's relevant. And the stories are terrific. We certainly encourage folks to go to www.ndunited.org, click on the podcast and hear these things. They're about 20 minutes long, the perfect length for your commute. Heck, in Fargo, I suppose you could probably listen to a couple of them on your commute. But they're all very good, and Tom Gerhart does them so well, and we are very, very proud of the project.
Well, we often feature them on Main Street, so thank you for that. Sure. Nick Archuleta is the president of North Dakota United. Thanks for being with us today.
It was my pleasure, Doug. Thank you for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We're celebrating our 10th year of radio on Prairie Public with a live taping, music, refreshments, and an exploration of the logic of jazz. Join me and my guest, jazz musician and philosopher, Mark Weinstein, for this free event on Tuesday, February 26th at 7 p.m. at the Empire Arts Center in Grand Forks.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 18th. Burley and Morton counties were involved in an interesting footnote of North Dakota history. Burley County is home to Bismarck, the state capital. And across the Missouri River in Morton County is Mandan, its sister city. But there was a time when Mandan was actually in Burley County. The Dakota Territorial Legislature created Morton County in 1873, named after an Indiana governor. The county government was organized in 1878. County commissioners were elected, and Mandan was appointed the county seat. But the 1879 legislature slashed off an 18-mile-wide strip of eastern Morton County and attached it to Burley County. This gets referred to as the beheading of Morton County, for it left the rest of the county unorganized. Some blamed it on a conspiracy of the legislature at Yankton, but subsequent legislation restored the strip back from Burley County, and on this date in 1881, Morton County was about to be made whole. Soon, the city of Mandan was incorporated. The governor appointed three new Morton County commissioners, and the county was replatted. 1916 brought another big change, with Grant County being created from Morton County's southern section. But despite that loss, Morton County remains one of the state's largest counties, larger than the state of Rhode Island. But that's actually no big boast, since you could fit 58 Rhode Islands into North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Tuesday on Main Street will feature a discussion about the Doctrine of Discovery, which will take place Friday and Saturday in Bismarck. The Doctrine of Discovery is a concept of international law regarding European claims on lands for colonization that ignored Aboriginal rights. Joining us for a preview will be Joseph McNeil Jr., one of the presenters, and the Reverend Karen Van Fossen, one of the event organizers. And we'll talk with Art Cullen, editor of the Storm Lake Times in Iowa. Cullen recently wrote an intriguing commentary titled, Help Wanted, Rural America Needs Immigrants. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.